AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Jack Rice is our legal expert. He's kind enough to join us. JackRiceLaw.com. That's JackRiceLaw.com. You're looking for a defense attorney. Jack is your guy. Hi, Jack. Thanks for the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be with you again, Matt.
Thank you. It's very nice to have you back. I enjoyed your sanity breaks I had over those few weeks we had you on during the trial. It was always nice to check in with you to get the straight direction on that.
Well, I have to tell you, when I look back at that thing, and you got to understand, I mean, part of what happens is that I look at what it was that Derek Chauvin was convicted of, and I looked at that tape, and I watched this like other people, and you also heard about a lot of the prior bad acts that didn't come in from this guy, and I really felt like, you know, he's a thug. The guy's a thug, right?
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, here's the weird part of it. Is that as a criminal defense lawyer, and I've been doing this a very long time, as a criminal defense lawyer, I'm wired a certain way. And so when I watch this, I look at it from the perspective of somebody who does that. And so I'm looking for process as much as I'm looking at everything else. And so it's very confusing sometimes, even for me, when I'm like, I want this guy to go down, and then as a defense attorney, I'm figuring out how to make him walk. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean?
No, exactly.
So it's a very strange place to be.
I would rather have that than a James Carville, the sun is always shining sort of thing. And the reality is, because it doesn't take into effect, and you and I talked all the time there about the possibility of all the things that could come back after the verdict is done. And what is the chance of, a court, a judge ruling that, you know what, this is going to have to get overturned. They're going to have to go back to trial again. I don't know. I mean, the fact that the way this came back so quick, from what you have seen, including that moment where the juror, there seems to be some questions about whether about some of the issues with one of the jurors, the one juror who's come forward, who is on, not the alternate that spoke out, but the actual juror. So far, have you seen anything that you feel is going to get a judge to go and say, okay, yeah, they need a new trial here?
Well, I mean, let's look at it like this. And again, everything that I just told you, let's accept that as my basic working premise, right?
Okay.
When we look at what happened here and you realize that we had this videotape that went everywhere to every corner of the planet, everybody saw this. And we saw commentary running 24 hours a day for darn near a year. We had the mayor and the governor and just about everybody else saying, he did it, fire him, put him in jail, charge him with murder, convict him of murder, he is a murderer, all of those things. That was before this thing even started. And then what we had was we had the city council pay out that $27 million.
Yeah.
And they did it at a very purposeful time. And by the way, they didn't even have to disclose it. It could have been private. They did it in the middle of jury selection that required them to bring six of those potential jurors back, and they actually had to kick some of them off. And then you had multiple other statements, including from a politician saying some things about heating things up in the streets and just a bunch of really terrible things. But I have to tell you, think of it like this. I think of, not as you said, the alternate, not what the alternate said, but what that actual juror who was disclosed later, who when he answered the juror questionnaire and he said twice, no, I had never been to a Black Lives Matter function. Now, from my perspective, my response would be, whether you went or didn't go doesn't mean you can't be fair and impartial, because that is the standard for being a juror. However, when you then subsequently, after you said no twice, and he did, you find out that, in fact, he did go to one in Washington, D.C., and he did wear a shirt that said, get their knees off our necks, which obviously applied to this particular case, and then lied about it or somehow magically forgot, which I find dubious. My fear is that when you think of it like that, what you could say is that this is a guy who knew what he knew, thought what he thought, and really wanted to be on this jury. Why? Because he wanted Derek Chauvin to go down. In other words, he was a ringer for the prosecution. And what makes it worse, remember, is that we don't know how much influence he had on the other 11 who had to convict. Maybe none. But the problem The problem is what you really want, and I think what we all really wanted, or at least we should have wanted, was the most transparent, most fair jury on the planet, because what we really wanted is we want everybody to say, we gave that guy every possible opportunity to establish that the state failed to prove their case. But now what you get is some people out there who may have been some of the Blue Lives Matter people or some of the white supremacist crazy lunatics who are now going to say, well, the reason he was found guilty was because there was a ringer on the jury. So that bothers me. You see what I mean?
And Brandon Mitchell is the juror that we're talking about who identified himself. Okay, so here's the where it gets – I'm going to challenge you as a lawyer because
– Bring it.
Okay. Well, probably not really well, but still, he wasn't necessarily a Black Lives Matter event. He was at a commemoration of the Martin Luther King speech. I Have a Dream speech, if I remember correctly. He was wearing the shirt, which I am not going to look past. But couldn't the prosecution make the argument? It's like, well, yeah, he was at this event. And is the argument just because black people are out there commemorating something that it's a Black Lives Matter event? And, I think the shirt becomes – I think it's necessarily a deal breaker as far as the verdict. But how likely could that defense be argued by the prosecution that, yeah, he was there, but it wasn't for Black Lives Matter. He was there for Martin Luther King.
Right, right. And again, that is the argument. And I think when we talk about it honestly, I think the real question is can you be at these kind of events and still be fair and impartial? That's the language. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, of course you can. Of course you can support Black Lives Matter and say, can I be fair and impartial? And so you can. And I think that what a court of appeals will do, what Judge Cahill will do is to say, of course you can. And in fact, he was asked specifically a couple of times whether he could be fair and impartial, and he said that he could. And so I think what you will find is, first of all, Cahill and the Court of Appeals, nobody wants to try this case again.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to try it again. There is no question about that issue. But my complaint is that what I really wanted is I wanted as many people as possible, including some of the Yahoo crazies on the other side, to sort of just drop their heads and say, you know what, you gave Chauvin every opportunity, and the evidence was so strong and it was so undeniable that they didn't need anybody who was a ringer. I just don't want to give them that excuse, because credibility is important, transparency is important. If this is the best criminal justice system on the planet, let's make it stand on its own, and let's not make mistakes so those people who are out there who are looking for the ways to make excuses for it don't have any. That's what I was really hoping for, and that's what I found a little frustrating.
And I thought Cahill did run the trial fairly well. I here is the human part, though. You and I talk about these things in just very kind of VCR instruction manual. I'll have to explain what a VCR is to everyone. VCR instruction manual kind of mentality is that this is the way it goes. The reality is
12 o'clock.
A.M. or P.M. the problem that you come into is that if I'm a judge that's going to hear this on appeal, in the back of your mind, you are running the fact that if I don't have some absolutely undeniable, rock hard reason to throw this verdict out, I want nothing to do with this, because let's face it, isn't this part of the argument that, you know, that people just don't get held accountable when they kill black people? And so you have this case. It truly is horrible. As you said, you watch it. He's a horrible guy. Do you think the human element will factor in on these judges realizing that, you know what, no, I don't want my name to be the person that basically validates the narrative of a two-tiered justice system?
You want to believe, and by the way, judges, and this is my opinion, judges want to believe that they can separate themselves sufficiently to make these calls almost academically. I don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. Because they are humans. And as humans, they live in this community too. And they see what they see, and they think what they think. They may try to create some space or some distance and try to be objective. But I think there are limitations to that, and we all have biases. Some of those biases we are aware of. Some of them I'm not sure if we are, and that includes judges. And I think that I can't imagine anybody. Remember, every single one of these judges is going to be up for election. Every single one. Is that they have to be conscious and aware that if they were the one to overturn, that's going to be the asterisk in the history books that may have their name attached to it. And that's something that I don't know if anybody would want.
Well, and to back up your point, we just had that ruling from the Minnesota Supreme Court where it was a unanimous ruling that because when the prosecution tried to apply another law to the case on the woman that was drunk, who was assaulted, and they said, no, you just can't do this. And it wasn't that they were saying, oh, well, we are victimizing the victim again because she was drunk. But the reality is, they said, is you just can't apply law willy-nilly. You have to apply the law. And they basically said very clearly to the state, you need to fix this now. And they did. So there are cases like that. It just is, I got to imagine, it's got to be a pretty much a lock-solid case if you're going to try to overturn this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question about it. And I mean, I don't want to go too far afield here, but that particular case for what people, if they don't recall this one, this is the one that went up before the Supremes here in Minnesota, where basically, where a woman alleged that a man had, they'd been out together, they were both drunk, and there was sexual contact, sexual penetration, but because she was under the influence, she couldn't give consent. And what they basically said was, well, hold on, wait a second. So you willingly were under the influence and then subsequently decided that you didn't want to give consent or couldn't give consent. The real problem with that, and this is to the credit of the Supreme Court here, and people are going to hate me for this, but think of the logic, is that if you have two people who decide they want to go out and get drunk, and then those two people decide that they're going to go have sexual contact in some capacity. The question then becomes, so we have two drunk people having sex. I'm saying this on the air, right?
Yeah.
Two drunk people. Here's my question. Which one of those is the victim, and which one of those is the perpetrator? That's the problem right there. Because what you could say is, well, which one consented? Well, if they're both drunk, doesn't that mean that neither can consent? And if the other one couldn't consent, then isn't the person who's with the person who can't consent, then that's actually the perpetrator, too. So in other words, you'd actually have to charge both, and then the other would have to be the victim in the other ones.
Yeah.
And think about how crazy that is for a sec.
Well,
so that's one of the struggles.
Well, and before anyone gets mad at Jack, I mean, that's exactly it. And the Minnesota Supreme Court came back and said, you need to clean this language up because you cannot take a woman who's drunk. That's not, you know, an endorsement of you can rape me. And they did. And the good thing is the legislature did pick that up. But that's the case. I mean, you have to have, yes, sometimes judges will go on out there and put forward very unpopular rulings, but you have to have pretty much, you know, lock tight, solid evidence that's the way you have to go.
It is important. It is important. And sometimes you have the judges who will come forward and say, you got to fix this because this law just doesn't make sense. And by the way, you could take it up even higher to the state or even federal Supreme Court and say, if I'm going to commit a crime, you have to tell me what the crime is beforehand because I have the right to know. It's a constitutional protection.
Mm-hmm. Jack Rice joining us. Jack, the federal charges that they're putting against the four officers here. One of the things I was very happy to see with the Chauvin trial, the case specifically, is they're bringing in that 2017 attack where he put his knee on the other kid for a longer period of time. They just show a pattern here that they clearly talk a little bit about that because that is also, you know, these guys are not going to get out of jail.
Yeah, I'm extremely pleased. I really am, and I hope everybody is on this. One of the things that happened, exclusive of these charges, is on April 21st, the AG, Garland, actually came in. Remember, he was the one who was going to be put up for the Supreme Court, the Attorney General in Washington, D.C. He announced an investigation looking at the Minneapolis Police Department. because what we saw during the Chauvin trial was they tried to characterize themselves as sort of above this. This is not who we are as a department, and this is not the standard to which we apply ourselves, nor the behavior that we have in the streets. Which, by the way, I think that you can look at the history of the department, and I think it says otherwise. And I think that's what A.G. Garland was talking about. And so they're looking more broadly, looking at the department itself, which I think is really, really important, because I think one of the things that Black Lives Matter has argued, and many others too, is that what the department and departments around the country have been doing is systemic, not individualistic. And that is a critical piece. Now, let's take a look at these indictments. These are actually looking at these four officers and in different configurations, but essentially they're going after them for civil rights violations federally. I love it. I love it, because what we're really talking about here is a willingness to say this is a federal court, a national court, looking at behavior of certain people and saying, you can't do certain things nationally because we have standards and this doesn't apply. It's not a local question. It's not a state question. This is a U.S. of A question.
The final thing I want to get to here before we get to go, because I know you got to run here. But Defendant Lane, one of the other officers in the case, there's some motions that are starting in here. The court for today filed Minnesota's response to Defendant Lane, who would ask the court to compel the state to disclose all Minneapolis Police Department use of force reports where another officer intervened from last 50 years. Lane said it has to establish a jury that it has not happened. In the filing, the state, though, put back that Lane is aware that it has happened in Minneapolis in the last 50 years. Lieutenant Zimmerman described such an incident in discovery when he intervened after a more senior officer hit a suspect and was asked the officer to back away. So it seems like that's going to be, for these other officers, part of their defense is going to be, well, no one really ever does this, but the state's already pretty much prepped for that.
No, there's no question. I mean, if you think about these charges, the federal charges, they're a bit different than what we saw here in state court. So in other words, for the feds to succeed in this case, what they would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt is that Chauvin and the others essentially acted willfully to deprive Floyd of his civil rights and used force that was constitutionally unreasonable. And remember, they can use as defenses things like, well, you know what, we were afraid, or we panicked, or we freaked out, or we were even just idiots and we used poor judgment. Because it's civil in nature, the standard is a little different. What they have to prove is a little bit different, and it's harder. But I still think that it's a worthy effort, because if what we continue to do is to ignore the reality that we have treated Black Americans, Black people in this country, differently for 400 years, what we're going to do is perpetuate that very lie that we've been telling ourselves all of that time into the future.
JackRiceLaw.com, JackRiceLaw.com. Jack, I can't tell you how much it's just a joy to talk to you, to get your insight on this stuff. Thank you very much for the time, my friend.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Take care. JackRiceLaw.com, best defense lawyer in town, hands down. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.